We'll be talking with John Layman, former Secretary of the Navy. He served as Naval Secretary and under the in the administration of Ronald Reagan. In fact, was the youngest person ever to hold that post. We'll be talking this morning about a bit about the history of the Navy. And he's written about that in his book, On Seas of Glory, the subtitle, Heroic Men, Great Ships, and Epic Battles of the American Navy, published by the Free Press, a book that he admits is perhaps somewhat subjective and not entirely comprehensive history of the Navy, but a lot of good stories in here about some of the personalities that made the Navy what it is, and some of the important engagements that did the same. The book is out now in bookstores if you're interested in reading it. And, of course, as we talk this morning with our guest, you're welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL. That's what you get if you match the numbers and the letters. And toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Questions are welcome at any point. All we ask of people who call is that they just try to be brief in their comments, but anyone's welcome to join the conversation. Mr. Layman, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, it's great to be here in the heartland where we seem to get most of our best sailors.
Well, I think it's interesting, isn't it, that so far away from the major bodies of water, you'd have a lot of important guys who were significant in the history of the Navy.
Well, that's because it's still true and it's always been true. Join the Navy and see the world.
And you're just, maybe a minute, we'll talk about your family, your connection with the Navy and your family. It didn't just start with you. It goes back several generations.
Yes, we've been kind of stuck here in Philadelphia where my fourth great-grandfather sort of started our naval tradition as a ship surgeon on the privateer Fair American. And I've had a lot of my forebears ever since have gone down to the great waters in naval ships.
It's interesting you make some observations about the Navy and about how sailors feel about their service branch. And it's certainly the case, I'm sure, that other people who've been through wars bond very strongly with their branch and maybe also with their, if they're pilots, with their airplanes. And maybe if they're, you know, guys who are in the tank corps with their tanks. But there's something that is different about the kind of connection that sailors have with the ships. And it may be, as you suggest, it's because not only do they fight the ship, it's their home. They live there.
That's right. It's a unique relationship that we have through history and do today build these things with the latest technology and then load them with sailors and send them off to live in their weapon systems for sometimes years at a time. And these ships last a very long time. The Constitution is still in commission 200 years after it was built. And indeed, three of those great super frigates, which were the greatest sailing warships ever designed by every world authority, three of them lasted into the Civil War, though they were built before 1800. And, you know, today we have the Iowa-class battleships are 60 years old, yet two of them are ready to go to war again, and two of them fought in Desert Storm, and that makes the great warships a part of history spanning many eras.
At the time of the Revolutionary War, the United States didn't have a navy; it had to be established. How did the sailors of that day go about trying to essentially invent the American Navy?
Well, it's a very interesting history because the American colonies were really marine colonies. The industry was almost all related to the sea. Even the agriculture, everything that was grown that was not eaten was grown for export primarily to back to England. All of the commerce, all of the transportation, if you wanted to go from Philadelphia to New York, generally you went by sea. If you wanted to go from New York to Boston, you went by sea. So We had a very, very well-developed marine industry at the time of the American Revolution, but not a military dimension to that. The Royal Navy at the time was the largest navy in the world, and we had many Americans serving as sailors, but in the Revolutionary Navy, the Continental Navy, we had only one professional naval officer, and that was Nicholas Biddle. He had served with Lord Nelson when they were both midshipmen. Again, a great Philadelphia family, but he was the only one. So we had to build a navy from scratch. But the main part of the military effort was really not done by the Navy at all. It was done by privateers. There were some 600 ships outfitted and manned by non-military people, given letters of marque and reprisal by the Continental Congress to go out and capture British merchant ships and men of war where they could. And this had an enormous effect because in the research I did over in Lloyd's Underwriters in London, I found that they have the logs of 3,000 British merchant ships captured by Americans in the Revolutionary War period, and 2,600 of those were captured not by the U.S. Navy but by privateers. And, of course, they were motivated by financial gain but also by patriotism. And this, in effect, eliminated 15% of the entire world British merchant marine and bankrupted quite a few very influential people in London. So when the war reached disaster for the British at Yorktown, it was the pressures of these London merchants and financiers on the king, who was not ready to give up at the time, even after Yorktown, that made him finally give up because the financial pressures were too enormous. So we owe a lot to the privateers, the citizen sailors of the Revolution.
Yeah, that's something that I think you write in the book. You feel their role has not been acknowledged, I think perhaps not only just in the Revolution, but also afterwards.
That's right. It's and it's understandable because, of course, the United States Navy has kept meticulous records down at the Washington Navy Yard. The archives of the U.S. Navy go all the way back to the Continental Navy in the Revolution. But nobody kept records for the privateers. There were all individuals outfitted by wealthy individuals and groups of individuals, and they were in it for profit, and when they did great things, like the Fair American, which I write about, captured 20-some major British merchant ships, made all their officers, including my fourth great-grandfather, very rich. But nobody kept records of that. I had six people digging for a year to really put the story together, whereas if you want to get the records of any of the great ships from the Continental Navy, they're right down there at the Washington Navy Yard. So it's understandable why all the history books have been written about the official Navy rather than the privateers, but they have a fabulous set of stories to tell.
Yeah. I suppose that I should know the answer to this question, but in the American Navy, did they award prize money like they did in the British Navy?
Yes, they did, right up through the Civil War. In fact, the main reason that there weren't any Union privateers in the Civil War, there were plenty of Confederate privateers, but the Union never issued letters of marque and reprisal in the Civil War because the American Navy, the United States Navy, the admirals wanted the prize money for themselves, and many of them made quite a bit of money capturing blockade runners and ships carrying contraband in and out of the southern ports during the blockade. But right up until then, and it was shortly after the Civil War that Congress changed the laws to prevent naval officers from sharing in the prize money of enemy captures. But that is why a great many naval officers became rich in all of our wars, and that was sort of that was not just the United States Navy, but a practice throughout all the major navies in the world.
Yeah, just and so people know what we're talking about. What would happen is if in battle you took were victorious over another ship, then and you captured that ship, you brought it home. If upon review it was considered, you know, there are ways of deciding whether or not it was appropriate, but if those were all found to be in place and then your country essentially bought the ship, then the proceeds were divided among the crew. The captain, the highest ranking officer, got the most, and then it was divided up according to a fixed formula in shares, and the officers got a little bit less, and then the seamen got even less. But if you were a part of the crew of a successful ship, even if you were an able seaman, this could be a significant amount of money if you did well in battle.
Well, typically, a capture of an East Indiaman, for instance, by an American Navy vessel, even down to the cabin boys, would make several years pay in just that one capture. And even if it was capturing an enemy naval vessel, for instance, in the War of 1812, the American frigates were tremendously successful in capturing British frigates and smaller combatants. And when, as an example, when the Macedonian was captured, a brand new British frigate was captured by the Stephen Decatur in the United States, it was taken back, and it was sold to the United States Navy. It was condemned as prize. There was a whole international system of prize courts in virtually every port. Even though he was being paid by and in a United States ship and captured an enemy Navy ship, when they brought it back, it was sold as prize and bought into the United States Navy, and Stephen Decatur got the money. Mm-hmm. Not a bad system. I wish they had it when I was SecNav.
Well, although I think that probably this is yet another reason for friction, shall we say, between the Army and the Navy. There's I think guys in the Army always, at least in the British Army, I think they were rather resentful of their naval brethren because there was no equivalent sort of institution for battles took place on land.
Yeah, in fact, there was an equivalent, although it didn't usually provide quite as lucrative a return. But for instance, when Wellington was in the Peninsular Campaign, he was able to keep quite a bit of legitimate booty, if you will, from the conquests of the Napoleonic army at the time. So the same thing applied, but there just wasn't nearly the opportunity to capture the kind of loot that was available at sea. And another thing that wasn't really quite comparable, as you point out, is that merchantmen, civilians, were quite legitimate prizes. Whereas there was not quite the same counterpart in land warfare. So it's a very interesting system. It worked pretty well. It motivated a lot of people. In fact, it motivated throughout the Revolution, the Continental Congress was complaining that they could never man fully, and we never did man fully, the United States Navy, because every available able-bodied seaman would far rather go to sea in a privateer, where his prospects of getting rich were far greater and where the danger of getting killed was far less, because the privateers were designed to run from British warships unless they were smaller than themselves, and not to fight, and instead to concentrate on capturing British merchantmen. So that created a bit of a complication for the Continental Navy.
Our guest this morning, John Layman, former Secretary of the Navy and the Reagan administration. His new book is On Seas of Glory. It's History of the American Navy. It's published by the Free Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that you write in the introduction of the book is that you think that, generally speaking, naval personalities fall into three general categories, one being those people who live for glory and for battle. And now, as we are talking here, have been talking a bit about the American Revolution, perhaps we should talk a little bit about John Paul Jones, who people will remember for saying something to the effect of, "I have not yet begun to fight." Apparently he really did, maybe not those words, but he really did do that in a naval engagement with a British ship where his ship was heavily damaged, and yet he wouldn't give up, and eventually he was victorious.
Well, he's a perfect example of the great, heroic, courageous figure who lives for battle. And in that battle where he was in a refitted merchantman, the Bonhomme Richard, sailing out of France against British merchant traffic primarily, he attacked a British convoy that was protected by a warship, a two-decker that was twice the size of Bonhomme Richard, the Serapis, and should have been devastated by twice as much firepower, and in fact the ship was, but he undaunted, while his ship was practically disabled and sinking, was able to maneuver to come alongside the Serapis and to attack and fight and to board and capture the British ship, even though it was twice the size. So and he captured the captain of the ship, and he was and took him back to Holland with the captured ship, and of course got the prize money for the Serapis. But while he had his counterpart, Captain Simpson, in custody, the King George III made Simpson a knight, and so. There's a famous quote from Paul Jones. He went to Simpson before he was released and said, "Well, I look forward to doing battle with you again. I promise to make you a lord." So it's a great story. This is what I try to do in On Seas of Glory, is to make accessible the really exciting stories and personalities and battles of the Navy to the average reader. I mean, we have a whole generation of kids and adults that have really been cheated of the great saga and the heroes of American history, because it became very politically incorrect over the last 10 years or so to teach American history to the extent it used to be taught. So as a result, most American kids have no idea of people like Jones, and not just Jones, but people like Biddle and Decatur and unknown people like Samuel Leach that I write about, and the unsung heroes. These are great stories, and so I tried not to, as you rightly pointed out at the beginning of the show, write a thorough, comprehensive, chronological history of the United States Navy. There are plenty of those excellent ones in the library. What I tried to do is, using a very meticulously researched backdrop of the chronological history of the Navy, to concentrate instead on telling the stories of the people that made that history, both the famous like John Paul Jones and the totally unknown like the Powder Monkey on Macedonian, for instance. These are great stories. Great human stories and great adventure stories, and again, also tell the stories of the ships that were evolved. Because one of the great stories of American initiative is the United States Navy has really been at the forefront of introducing high technology from the very beginning. As I said earlier, the Constitution was one of six frigates that represented an ingenious design of another fellow Philadelphian, Joshua Humphreys, who built a frigate that was really faster and more heavily armed and really almost invulnerable to the counterpart firepower of the same sized or same class of ship in the Royal Navy. And as a result, they really kicked butt in the War of 1812 because of the superior technology.
Yeah, I think it's at one point you observe in the book that perhaps now people think of World War II as the golden age of the American Navy, and yet before World War II, the golden age of the American Navy was the War of 1812.
Well, that's right, because after the Revolution, we had a period not entirely unlike the current period. We had Muslim fundamentalists in the Barbary Coast, which is the coast of North Africa, where there were these Muslim pashas, and they were seizing and enslaving American citizens and stealing the ships, and they felt this was a proper jihad against the infidels. And And so for 20-some years, we had to send expeditions against them. That's where our Navy really developed its professionalism and developed its technology, in these series of wars with the Barbary pirates, because, of course, the Royal Navy would no longer, indeed not only would they not protect American ships, obviously, after the American Revolution, but they actually encouraged these Muslim fundamentalists to attack American shipping. So finally, we defeated one after another of them, and that meant that we had a very experienced and battle-hardened cadre of sailors and gunners and captains like Stephen Decatur, so that when the British in the Napoleonic Wars declared they would not observe our neutrality and were impressing, stealing our merchant sailors and putting them into their warships, and war was declared, we absolutely flabbergasted the Royal Navy and the British public by actually defeating the best of the Royal Navy in head-to-head battles in the first two frigate battles of the war, when Constitution defeated the Guerriere, and then Decatur captured Macedonian, and then Constitution went on to destroy and sink the Java, which was a similar size ship, and a half a dozen other British warships after that. This put the United States Navy on the map worldwide. Suddenly, everybody in the world took notice, because here was a very professional, elite force, much, much smaller, of course, than the Royal Navy, that had what even the Royal Navy were recognizing were the best ships in the world. And suddenly we were launched onto the world stage. So it was indeed a golden age of the United States Navy, and it gave the United States a kind of sense of global capability and a sense of self-confidence in the world that is an integral part of our American psyche.
We're here at a midpoint. We have some callers we'll get right to. Let me again introduce our guest. We're speaking with John Layman. He served as Secretary of the Navy in the Reagan administration and is the author of a book that tells some of the history of the American Navy going back to the Revolution and continuing to the present. His book is titled On Seas of Glory, and it's published by the Free Press. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Let's start in here with a caller in Danville. That's line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a copy of a book just entitled Your Navy, published in 1946, and evidently was written for naval recruits. Is that still being printed by the Navy for their personnel?
No, I think you have a collector's item there. There are there are books that for recruits that that give give a summary of naval history, and there is a standard text given to all sailors. Of course, the Blue Jackets Manual, which does include customs and traditions, and as well as the professional skills and so forth. But what you have is you should hold on to. It'll be valuable. It is valuable.
Well, I've reread it many times. I had two copies, but I gave one away. But the other question I wanted to ask was, we had heard or read of the Great White Fleet that Theodore Roosevelt sent around the world, and somewhere I read that part battleships were black in time of war, and that sometimes the very act of starting to paint your ships would be a disastrous diplomatic maneuver, and from that was combined the current battleship gray. Is there any truth to that?
Well, there is some truth to it, but the ships were painted white when they were serving, as our Asiatic fleet was, out in the tropics, because it got so hot in those, particularly that era of the first battleships and cruisers, the first fully iron and steel ships without air conditioning. They got in unbelievably hot. But if they painted them white, of course, they reflected the heat and were much cooler inside. So that's... as you rightly point out, you don't want to be painted white when somebody's trying to shoot at you. So when there was an alert or there was an effort to go into battle, then generally a kind of camouflage of various, there were all different designs, but the ships were painted black sometimes, or sometimes gray, or sometimes a mixture. The battleship gray really evolved because at sea, against the haze of the normal weather, the gray is the least able to be visually outlined. So that was the main reason. But in World War II, they used a lot of different patterns of zigzag camouflage and so forth to break up the outline. So enemy ships, and particularly kamikazes, could not identify what kind of ships, whether big or small, from a long way off.
I see. Well, I imagine those white ships got unbelievably dirty when they coaled up.
Well, that's right, but you need a lot of sailors on a warship of any kind for battle, and when you're not battling, you got to keep them busy. So, chipping and painting and repainting and washing and scrubbing is a very old naval tradition.
I see. Well, thanks so much.
All right, thank you. Let's come back here locally to caller on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like to take issue with your use of the term Muslim fundamentalist. The pirates in Tripoli were pirates, purely and simply. Muslim fundamentalism, as we know it today, has a much later genesis. And I think we don't need to use language loosely. We have enough of a problem fighting terrorists without turning this into a war with Islam.
Well, I sympathize with your sentiments, except I think I disagree with them, because if you read the documents at the time, the reason that the Barbary Pashas felt no compunction about enslaving and selling, indeed, American sailors into slavery and or killing them or torturing them, or that they were infidels, and they believed, I'm not being a theologian, whether it was erroneous or rightly, but they believed the Quran taught that infidels could be enslaved. And as you know, during that period, four times as many black Africans were sold to these Muslim fundamentalists because of what they felt was a religious blessing to do so than were shipped to the Americas. So In my view, in my reading of history, they were indeed Muslim fundamentalists, and they felt piracy was a perfectly legitimate activity against unbelievers.
You're quite right that they were Muslims, even as the pirates in the Straits of, what is it, Malacca, are largely Muslim today, but they are not fundamentalists in either case.
Well, what would you call them if they believe that they could enslave people? If that's not fundamentalism by a literal reading of the Quran, what is?
Were our Americans who bought slaves fundamentalists too?
I think so, yeah.
I don't think so. They were slaveholders.
Well, they were. They believed a basic, simplistic view of Christianity that allowed them to think that that was moral. That's fundamentalism, if not extremism.
That is not the case. What you've got in the one case is piracy, pure and simple, and that.
Well, fundamentalists can be pirates. And pirates can be fundamentalists, and indeed they were.
Please let me finish. That area of North Africa had been a pirate's nest at least since the time of Cervantes, when he was held there as a hostage for several years.
That's right, by Muslim fundamentalists.
By Muslims who happened to be pirates.
I think I'm going to jump in here because I think both the caller and Mr. Lehman have stated their cases, and I don't think we're going to get the two of you guys to agree.
Well, thank you, David. I agree with you.
And forgive me for wanting to move on. We do have a few other people here, and I will do that going on next to line number two, which is another local caller. Hello.
Yes, David, you really should have let that discussion go on. Although it was one of my questions, I'll just skip to a primitive question. I'd like a distinction made between piracy and privateer. And the second question is, exactly how many vessels do we have committed, Mr. Secretary, to the blockade of Cuba? And what is their purpose and function? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, the first question is the difference between piracy and privateering was that international law, customary international law, came very early to recognize the right of sovereigns to commission private ships in their service to capture enemy under the rules of war, capture enemy ships, and indeed, there were no real navies in the sense we know them now when those when that customary international law evolved. The British force that defeated the Spanish Armada, for instance, and indeed nearly all the ships in the Armada itself, some 300 of them, were in effect privateers. They were privately owned ships in commission to their king and queen in the case of the UK. So. The idea of using private ships for public purposes is deeply rooted in private law, but you need to have an official commission under international law, and these came to be either privateering commissions, and this is sort of a fine legalistic distinction, or letters of marque and reprisal issued by the sovereign. If you didn't have them and you captured a ship, and you did not have such a letter aboard or a commission, then you could be summarily executed and hanged under international law as a pirate. So that's the difference between the two. As to how many ships are blockading Cuba, I don't believe any of them are, nor have there been since the Cuban Missile Crisis. The economic sanctions in force against Cuba are really enforced at the U.S. borders and in U.S. customs rather than blockading the Cuban coast. I'm not a big fan of economic sanctions. I think they rarely, if ever, work, but they've been in place for a long time, but they've not been enforced by the U.S. Navy or the Coast Guard.
All right. Hope that gets to the questions of the callers. I think on the distinction between a pirate and a privateer, I think perhaps if you were, say, a merchant who had your ship taken by a privateer, you would say there is no difference.
Well, no, I think you might not even be able to say that if you were captured by a pirate because the pirates very frequently killed all the people.
Fair enough. Fair enough. To Chicago, line number three. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if your guest is familiar with the story of the Indianapolis.
Yes, very familiar.
Surrounding that crew.
Yes, that's it's one of the great tragedies of World War II, and as you know, there are several good books, including a recent bestseller on that tragedy, and this was the cruiser Indianapolis that carried the first atomic bomb to Saipan for its preparation to be dropped on Japan, and then when returning from that, under radio silence, was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine and was not reported discovered missing for days and days afterwards. And the crew were in the water all that time, and sharks ended up eating, I guess, about three-quarters of them in a terrible ordeal. And they were finally discovered by a PBY, and then another destroyer came and was able to rescue them. But that led to a court-martial, an inquiry that most people recognize today was a scapegoating of the captain, who was unfairly victimized as being at fault.
Well, I was about to mention that. There are, even today, and I understand out of 1,196 men, 880 were killed.
Yeah.
The crew, the survivors, feel that Captain McBay was wrongly reprimanded for that. They have intense loyalty for him, and most of them said that if he were to captain a ship today, they would go out with him again.
Yes, that's right. It was a real miscarriage of justice. They even went so far as to bring from Japan the captain of the submarine that torpedoed him to try to get him to testify against Captain McVeigh.
Well, I understand that he said that nothing the captain could have done would have avoided what happened.
That's right, but he wasn't. That wasn't why he was brought. He did not do what the prosecutors had hoped he would do. But the whole the idea of having an enemy captain come and testify against an American captain was unprecedented, and
especially 3 months after the war was over.
Yeah, right. I mean, it was really something else.
There's been a move on to rehabilitate his name. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I think generally it has been rehabilitated. I think that there's a general recognition, certainly among naval historians, and I think the U.S. Navy itself, that he was very wrongly scapegoated, and I believe the record has been corrected, but I'm not sure of that, because Graham Clater was the Secretary of the Navy, and Graham Clater, I believe, was his brother-in-law.
Yeah, I know you're short on time, so I'll hurry with the next question. Do you know that there is a move afoot to try and get Dory Miller the medal that he never got? Do you know anything about that?
I'm sorry, I'm unfamiliar with that case.
That was the case of the African-American at Pearl Harbor that apparently shot down some planes, even though he was on the mess. And at that time, blacks didn't serve in anti-aircraft units.
Right.
But apparently this man shot down a couple of airplanes and was recommended, but never got his medal and was killed a couple of years later.
Well, I'm not familiar with the case, but if there was evidence that the medal was denied for any racial discrimination, the case certainly ought to be reopened.
Yeah, there was a lot of that happening back then, and they've gone through the records since then and tried to straighten a lot of that out, I guess.
Well, it should be.
Okay, thank you.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left, and as part of Focus 580, our guest, John Layman, former Secretary of the Navy. He is the author of a book that presents some of the history of the American Navy, the people who made it, and the battles that forged it. His book is titled On Seas of Glory, Heroic Men, Great Ships, and Epic Battles of the American Navy. It's published by the Free Press. And certainly we have time for a few other callers. Someone wants to pick up the telephone, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. As I mentioned a little bit earlier, we're talking about Jean-Paul Jones. You write that one of the categories that naval personalities fall into are these men who live for glory and for battle. Another of these, Stephen Decatur. And I'm interested in hearing the story of he did something that was said to be, by no less than Horatio Nelson, said to be the most daring act of the age. What was it that he did?
Well, during one of the wars against the Pasha of Tripoli, one of the Barbary pirates, so-called, the frigate Philadelphia was blockading the port and unfortunately ran aground on a shoal right off Tripoli Harbor. And as a result, it was captured because it was unable to maneuver, being stuck on the shoal. And so the Pasha took it into the Tripolitan Navy, and there it was as a very formidable, even more formidable threat to his ability to grab American merchantmen. So Stephen Decatur volunteered to take a lateen-rigged schooner, really, or more of a cutter, in with a force at night to destroy the Philadelphia, because they didn't feel they'd be able to get it underway with the numbers of people they'd take aboard. So what he did was sail in and sail right up in the cover of night to Philadelphia, board it with his men, and set fire to it, killed most of the crew that were on deck, set explosive charges and set it on fire, and got away just as it exploded. So it was quite, that was where Stephen Decatur first made his fame, and of course he went on to many other great exploits in the subsequent War of 1812.
Maybe we could talk a little bit here in the time remaining about the Civil War. As people think about the Civil War and look at its history, most of the emphasis is on the battles that took place on land. But there were naval engagements that were significant during the war. Here, perhaps we might talk a little bit about another person. This that you put in a different category of those officers that perhaps were, in your words, equally courageous but more prudent. Perhaps we could talk about David Farragut.
Yes, David Farragut is a unique figure, and he does represent one of the three different types that I highlight in On Seas of Glory. He actually fought in two wars. He was in the War of 1812 in the famous Battle of Valparaiso as a ship's boy. And then 50 years later, really led the American Navy, the Union Navy, in the Civil War. And what he did was execute the strategy that Winfield Scott had recommended at the beginning of the war, which was so-called Anaconda strategy, which was to take a force up the Mississippi from the south and down from the north to split the Confederacy in two, so that Confederacy would not have access, particularly to the food and the beef from the western states of the Confederacy, and not be able to use the arteries of the Mississippi for their maneuvering and logistics, and then also to strangle them like an anaconda with a blockade of all of the ports in the Confederacy, and it was really Farragut who executed that very effectively, and the role of the Navy in not only in taking control of the Mississippi and the Battle of New Orleans and the Battle of Vicksburg and so forth, but gradually strangled the Confederacy by denying it the ability to export its cotton and its other crops to get money and to bring in arms and ammunition to supply its army, even though there were always blockade runners that were able to get in and out. The cost of doing so and the volume was a trickle compared to what it otherwise would have been. But the Navy also played another role, and that was the Europeans, particularly Britain, very much favored the Confederacy because they would much rather have the United States split in two and be weakened and not provide the kind of commercial world threat that they saw, and also not because at the time both still had ambitions in the New World. So the United States Navy became was used very effectively by Lincoln to threaten the Europeans, both the French and the Brits, with in effect going to war against them, because over as the war went on, particularly by 1864. The Navy had been built up to over 600 ships and was the biggest Navy in the world and had the most ironclads, had the latest Dahlgren guns, and was a formidable threat to British commerce and indeed to French commerce. So the Navy played a huge role, and Farragut was its real hero. I mean, if you look at that picture in my book, I mean, the leadership of that guy just jumps right off the paper, the charisma, the strength, the presence of the guy, because he led by example. He was a brilliant man, but he had a great common touch, like Nelson, for his men. And in the Battle of Mobile Bay, which closed off the last major Confederate port, he was up in the masthead while the shot and shell were bursting around him. And for the most senior admiral in the Navy, that was quite an inspiring example to the sailors and to the whole Navy, and indeed the world. So it's a great story. He's a great man, and Americans have to be reminded that there are really great men in our past and in our present. And so that's what I try to do, is not to. This is not some hagiography. It's really an effort to show warts and all. But even if you dig out the worst warts of most of the people I've got in this book, they are magnificent people.
Yeah, it is a wonderful portrait of Farragut, that photograph.
Yeah, another one is another portrait that where the person just jumps out at you. I think you'll agree, is Uriah Levy.
Yes.
The first Jewish flag officer, hero of the War of 1812, and a brilliant leader himself, a handsome, courageous leader. And then when in between wars, he got rich on Wall Street. And then when Thomas Jefferson, one of his heroes, died, he saved Monticello from being destroyed. He bought it and he restored it to its original shape, and his nephew, and then donated it to what is now the Monticello Foundation. So there are all sorts of fascinating people like that in our naval history that most people don't know about. So I've tried to sort of excavate them. And the third category we didn't talk about are the citizen sailors, that the people who are not professional sailors and certainly not professional military people, but when the war comes, they rally to the colors, they go to sea, they learn the ropes, as they say, they serve with great courage and win our wars, and then when they're over, they go back to their plows and their doctor's offices and go back to their business. That is unique to the American Navy. That is a tradition that no other Navy really has. And the ratios, like in World War II, were 70 reservist citizen sailors to every regular Navy person. So this is the kind of tradition that makes us such a great nation today, and it's time more people knew about it.
Well, there we're going to have to stop because we've used the time. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Lehman, for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Our guest, John Lehman, former Secretary of the Navy. The book, if you'd like to read it, is titled On Seas of Glory, published by the Free Press.